Accession number 27772, reel number 1.
John Wolstenholme, reel 1. Can we start at the beginning, and can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Morecambe, in Lancashire, in 1920. But I was brought up in Oldham, because my father was in the cotton business in the cotton belt of Lancashire, southeast Lancashire. He eventually became the raw cotton buyer for his spinning company, and that meant he didn't go and buy his cotton, of course, in the States, but he went down to Liverpool to see the cotton shipped in off the boats in Liverpool, and then take the samples, choose the quality of cotton he required. I will take 25 bales of that, please. And the deal was done.
And were you an only child? Or did you
have no, I have a younger brother who's 2 years younger than I. But we have been lived apart for most of our lives. He being in the home civil service, and myself after the war in the overseas civil service. So we were separated by, at times, considerable distances.
And where were you brought up?
In Oldham. And through my early youth, until I went to school in Manchester, which is only next door. And then on, after that, came across to Leeds, to the university.
And you were at grammar school, weren't you, in Manchester?
I was at the grammar school in Manchester, yes. For 6 years.
And then you went up to Leeds. When was that? When did you go to Leeds?
In Leeds, it was 1938. I had my first year at Leeds before the war started. The war started just as I was about to begin my second year at uni.
And what were you studying?
Agriculture. But as I got closer to my finals, I decided that I would never make an adequate agronomist. I was never any good at knowing what to do about growing potatoes or wheat or whatever. But I was always interested in cattle and milk production in particular, which led me to go up to the west of Scotland agricultural college dairy school outside of Ayr for 2 university summer vacations to study for the diploma, national diploma in dairying, in which I happened to be successful, and that led to a new career, well, my first career in the overseas civil service.
Now, where were you in September 1939?
Well, I was at home, and it was, what, 3 weeks, was it? So, was it? Yeah, it was about 3 weeks before I was due to go back to Leeds for my final year, my second year at university. So I was at home in Oldham.
And do you remember the events of the 3rd of September?
I do, yes.
Where were you? Were you at home with your parents?
Yes. Because at that stage, the build-up to the war and my being at home in university vacation, I had nothing much else to do but listen to the radio, read the papers leading up to this, the Munich Agreement and Chamberlain getting that piece of paper which he waved at the crowd as he got off the plane, signed by Adolf to say, and saying, peace in our time, which 3 weeks later was no more, or the peace wasn't.
How quickly did life change for you after the
war? It didn't when I was at university, except insofar as there were things that extras at university that one was coerced into doing, like fire watching, like I felt it was a good thing to join the University Officer Training Corps, like helping to analyse the Ministry of Agriculture's census, farm censuses, which was always, it was thrown at us as an agriculture student, as a being a, of national importance. So we sat down in our vacations and spent hours annotating and collating these agricultural censuses, farm censuses in, well, it was the West Yorkshire, I suppose.
Could you tell me a little bit about the OTC, the Officer Training Corps? What sort of activities did you do?
Very similar to any other OTC in public schools. You got dressed up in uniform for parades, which even in those days, at the start of World War II, was still the uniform of World War I. A bit antiquated and rather fancy dress sort of thing. However, we were led and taught by professional soldiers in all sorts of things like drill and arms drill, how your arms, small arms works, and how to use them, firing practices, a certain amount of field drill, field operations, but on a fairly simple scale. You passed your exams in various grades. You went, you got a red star for the first exam you passed successfully, and then you got a gold star for the next. And I, over the 2 years I was in the OTC, got both stars, whatever that meant. I can't remember. But it certainly, when I was drawn into the army after I graduated, came in very handy because I knew half of what they were teaching me at the recruit centre when I joined the army.
You were called up, I think, at the end of 1941. Did that make
sense? I'll have to take a rain check on that date. But the thing was that in those days, as long as I was an agricultural student at university, I was in a reserved occupation. Had I gone into an agricultural employment immediately after graduation, I would have remained. I would have remained in an exempt occupation, that is exempt from armed service. However, that wasn't the case for me. I was expecting to carry on at uni for an additional fourth year, but as I would have been the only student on that course, they decided in wartime it was not on, so I was thrown out of university, to use a common phrase, 1 year earlier than I expected, with no prospect of immediate employment. And immediately that happened, I was no longer in a reserved occupation. And, of course, I was only 21, a very desirable age for the services, the armed services. And so I was sent before a board to determine which bit of the forces I should join and recommend when I should be inducted. And that was the following. I graduated in 41 and I got my call-up papers to report to the first recruit camp early, very beginning of January 42.
How did you feel about this, about the reserved occupation post being no longer available to you? Did you, had you wanted to do that, or did you, were you not too bothered?
In actual fact, the disappointment about that, it happened 12 months before, because from being a small boy first going to grammar school, my great ambition in life, and don't ask me where it came from, I have no idea, but I always had an ambition that I wanted to study forestry, join the colonial service as a forester and work in Africa. Unfortunately, at that time I was advised that forestry was a dying occupation, and I should perhaps rather go into agriculture, which I then did. You were supposed to apply for a colonial office scholarship at the end of your second year at university, so that they had plenty of time to decide who they would choose and slot them in for the scholarship work. Unfortunately, because the war had already started, they decided that these scholarships were being temporarily put into abeyance, and so my ambition looked as though it was going to die an unnatural death before it went very far. So that was my first disappointment. Of course, I had no other ambitions for employment thereafter. And when I was suddenly thrown onto the market, as you might say, I took it as a matter of course. I wasn't exactly volunteering to be a soldier, but everybody else was having to put up with it, and I had no good argument as to why I should be the exception rather than the rule. So that wasn't in itself, didn't affect me in quite the same way as not being able to get the Colonial Office Scholarship I'd set my heart on years before that.
So you were called up, and you were posted. Where were you posted to?
I was. Well, it was decided, under some pressure from myself, that I was going to join the Royal Signals. That was mainly because my younger brother was already in the Royal Signals, and my cousin on my mother's side was also in the Royal Signals, and I thought we should keep it as a family affair. Otherwise, I had no other reason to do that. But it turned out to be the right one for me. Having accepted that this was where I was going to serve, I was eventually called up, I think it was the 5th of January, 42, to a recruit training centre for the signals at Prestatyn in North Wales. And I stayed there about 3 months, I think, maybe four, I don't know, a very short period of time.
Can you tell me a little about the training that you underwent in that period?
Well, like all first recruits in the army, went through all the usual things, how to carry your drill on the square, your marching and all the rest of these things. You were taught how to handle your rifle, how to keep it clean, how to fire it. In those days, I was a first class shot. No longer. But it just so happened that it paid off. Having had 2 years in Leeds University OTC, I had already had experienced most of the things they were teaching me in the first few weeks at this recruit training centre. And when our squad drill corporal, he wasn't sergeant, corporal got laryngitis, he suddenly sent for me and said, right, you can be my voice and you can take my drill periods. And so I became his voice on the drill square. But having done all this in the OTC, it was relatively easy for me to take charge with the corporal standing behind me, prompting me. That played into the next move that happened. They decided that I was officer material, so they would send me to a pre-octu course to teach me more about the technicalities of signals equipment and signals work, and that was in Catterick Camp. which was very handy because at the end of the 3 months after I'd learnt how telephones and wireless sets and teleprinters and all sorts of technological stuff worked, I was on the doorstep to march across the road and into Optu as an officer cadet for the next 9 or 10 months. And then passed out of there after various alarms and excursions and vicissitudes that one endures in those circumstances, especially in Catterick Camp, which is a very cold place. I was commissioned into the Royal Signals, and I think it was just after my 23rd birthday, in other words, in February 43.
What do you recall of the Octu, your training, your Octu period at Catterick?
Well, it was very hard work. Compared with how the ordinary squaddies in the army were housed, we were lucky because we were living in a relatively new barrack building with rooms which housed not more than 6 cadets. We had our own mess, which to a large extent was like many other messes. The only trouble was it was a clean building, a relatively new building, and it was up to us to keep it clean. And it was all beautiful, pale wooden floors, which had to be waxed. It was very hard work, because you can imagine coming off the Yorkshire moors with steel-shod boots, which were all wet and muddy. You can imagine the mess it made on these beautifully polished floors. So every weekend, that was half a morning on a Saturday, polishing and waxing these floors. Hard work. That was apart from the training, which was, of course, technical training and also tactical exercises in field work were also quite hard work. And fitness was of prime importance, of course, throughout. So it was hard work. Hard graft for 9 or 10 months.
Were you the only course, Octu course, going on at that time? Or
no.
Others
and I cannot remember the distance between courses, but there was more than one, because there was a chappie that I had known at Leeds who was doing a degree in arts, who was a year behind me in Octu. No, I beg your pardon, not a year, several months behind me. He was on following course. So that was another course I knew was there because I knew this chappie. Mm. And also, as it happened, there was also on that same Octu course, a year, these months behind me, was a laddie who had joined the Royal Signals in this country, but he was... family home was what is now Zimbabwe, Southern Rhodesia as it then was, with whom I became quite friendly, and in actual fact, lo and behold, we were eventually joined forces in the same unit in Italy. So, oddly enough, these odd acquaintances blossomed into a lot more. And I also met him at his own home in Zimbabwe after I was... left the army many years and was a traveller in Africa. Strange world. After I was commissioned, I was posted to 8 Corps Signals, which was stationed fairly close to Catterick, somewhere north, and I cannot now remember just where it was, but it was still in that quite close. And I was... posted to 41 line section of 8 Corps Signals, and as a second lieutenant newly commissioned, I was put under another chap who was in charge of that section, who was a full lieutenant, had a bit more experience than I was. Taught me the whys and wherefores of how to proceed with a line section, And of course, if you talk line sections in the Royal Signals now, they'll look at you as though you're a bit mad because they never heard of such things. We don't use telephones anymore of that sort.
And for how long were you with them, and what sort of work did you do while you were with them?
Well, after I was left alone as being in charge of the section, this more senior chappie being moved on to another unit within 8 Corps Signals, I relied heavily on my sergeant major and sergeants and non-commissioned officers for their technical ability and experience to carry me through. I travelled around. Of course, it was as ever in those circumstances, practice, 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 until you were sick and tired of doing the same old things over and over and over again. However, the great thing was that we moved about from that particular first location with 8 Corps. I moved across to Thirsk for a very short time, not very many weeks. And from Thirsk we moved down to somewhere near York, and I can't recall just where it was, but in that area. And thereafter we moved down to a place near Swaffham, and I was still in charge of the line section. That lasted through until I would, something of a bit of a guess, it must have been towards the end of August that same year, 43, when I was summoned to report to the CO, who were rather a smirk on his face, told me that I was being posted to Special Operations. He didn't enlarge on that. I rather got the impression that I was being sentenced to death, and the quicker it came, the happier he would be. Perhaps I'm maligning the chap, I don't know, but that was what the smirk on his face said to me, but I may be quite wrong. But anyway, I got warning that I was being posted to Special Operations, and I didn't know what that meant at all.
And you hadn't volunteered, and you had
no sense of... No, I had just summoned one day to the CO's presence and was told, oh, Wolstenholme, you have been selected to serve with Special Operations. We will let you know when and where you're to report. So I went back and sort of was a bit nonplussed and just waited for the summons. And when it came, not very long afterwards, I got a letter which said that I was to report to Major XYZ, I can't remember his name, it isn't important, in room something or other, Horse Guards, London. And I thought, well, that, for starters, is a rather strange address, and it doesn't tell me anything. And this would be the beginning of September, very beginning of September. 43. I reported to room whatever it was, Horse Guards, and here was Major Y sitting in a little room. Ah, yes, Wolstenholme. Right. Will you report to such and such a place, a certain person in such and such an address, Baker Street? Yes, sir. So I toured across from Whitehall to Baker Street into this heavily sandbagged building, which in actual fact I later learned had been the headquarters of Marks and Sparks. I didn't know that at the time. Bowled in there, I was interviewed by one or two people. And it was at that point I understood what Special Operations was. It was, in fact, Special Operations Executive, SOE. That didn't mean anything more to me, except it now had a name. And that I was to catch a certain train that afternoon to Henley-on-Thames, where I would be met. And I said words to the effect of, what, no evening in London? To which the reply was, no, you will catch that train, there's your train warrant, and you will be met. which happened as said. I was met together with several other people doing the same thing. Four or five, six, something like this. We were piled into the back of an army truck and taken to a very large place, I believe. What do you call it? A big mansion, which they knew, SOE knew, as SDS 54. And I was in there, taken in there, quick tour around, evening meal, next morning report to room so-and-so. And there I was untaught all my army signals procedures, retaught all SOE's signals procedures, and there's something, a little bit about the sort of equipment they used, and a little bit about ciphers. And that lasted 3 weeks, and I was sent for one day and told, right, you may have 1 week's leave, at the end of which you will be posted to one of our establishments near Algiers. So I went home, worked through the sorts of gear I was supposed to kit myself out with for North Africa, packed it all up in a nice new steel box, and came back, and then was told, right, you are catching a plane from somewhere down in Hampshire or somewhere down there, wartime airfields. And you will have civilian clothes and carry your civilian passport. Very nice. It turned out because we were going to to Portugal, a night stop in Portugal, which was not a combatant country, so I had to be a civilian. And from there, after about 3 hours sleep, because we flew halfway across the Atlantic and then all the way back, to Oporto, spent a few hours in a very nice hotel, thank you, I could have done with a week there, but then we were carried, and still in as civilians, to Morocco, where I was deposited, or we, because there were by now four of us, all travelling together, for SOE, and we were put into an hotel until onward flights could be arranged for us. The onward flight happened to be United States Air Force Dakota with one window missing, so it was very cold and drafty. And we eventually pitched up at Algiers Airport, where we were met by chaps in army British Army uniform and transported westward to an upmarket French holiday camp resounding under the name of Club de Pin, which is on the beach, about 25 kilometres, I think, something of that order, west of Algiers City. Very nice.
John Wolstenholme, Reel 2. So you'd arrived at Massingham.
Yes.
And what were your duties there?
I was informed that I was destined to move across to Italy as soon as that was possible. In the meantime, I was to work in the signals office at Massingham, because of course by then it was the main communication between the Western Med and London, the Eastern Med being still at that time dealt with, as I understood it, from Cairo.